From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. Coming up on the show today, we look at a new report from the Sierra Club, predicting dire consequences if Utah's vast fossil fuel reserves are extracted and burned. We'll speak with the Sierra Club's Tim Wagner to hear about the global and local consequences highlighted by the report.
Estimates are anywhere from 2 to 5 barrels of water per barrel of oil. So if a barrel of oil is roughly 42 gallons, start to do the math. So if we're talking about 2.6 billion barrels of crude, take that times 42, and then you start to understand the amount of water in an already starved watershed where we supply the water to 35 million people downstream on the Colorado River.
That and your local headlines just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks for joining us today on The Rundown. Coming up on the show, we'll be talking with Tim Wagner of the Sierra Club about a new report on fossil fuels extraction in Utah. But first up, we have these headlines. The state of Utah might not seem like the most obvious setting for the 2016 Democratic Party's convention, particularly given the state's reputation as a haven for conservative politics. But on Tuesday, the Democratic National Committee made that notion more than just a pipe dream. DNC officials have announced that they are requesting proposals for hosting the convention from 15 cities across the country, including Salt Lake City. Other municipalities in the running include Chicago, New York, Indianapolis, Detroit, Las Vegas, Nashville, and Atlanta. Utah Democratic Party Executive Director Matt Lyons says hosting the party's convention will be huge for local Democrats, not to mention for the city and state in general.
Thousands of people, you know, tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people will come to the city and come to the region for the national convention. Everyone from candidates to elected officials to the media. And so the impact of that on our, you know, hospitality industry, the impact that on our, you know, different communities is phenomenal. I think that, you know, the state will certainly consider it. I know that, you know, Salt Lake City was very supportive when the RNC was considering the city for the 2012 convention. I do know that even the Democrats are supportive, and I think the state will be supportive of the DNC coming here as well, just because of the, you know, the big opportunity is to highlight Utah.
As to why the Democratic Party would want to host their convention in one of the reddest states in the Union, Lyon thinks there's more to Utah than many people realize, and that national Democrats are paying attention.
Utah's changing. We've got a growing Hispanic-Latino population. The LDS community is beginning to look towards the Democratic Party as a party that is willing to be practical and willing to roll up their sleeves and get things done. And I think the national level is looking at our leaders that come from Utah and seeing that, you know, we can accomplish a lot here in a red state. And I think that that's something that they want to highlight.
Even if a city is not part of Tuesday's 15-city list, the DNC says that they will accept proposals from any interested city until June 6th, at which point Provo will officially be out of the running. Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker's office could not be reached immediately for comment. A mining company in Ghana says it has been using the plane registered to a Utah bank that became the subject of international intrigue after it was spotted in Iran. The company Engineers and Planners said in a statement that the plane took Ghanaian businessmen to Iran. The New York Times published a story last week revealing the presence of the plane at Tehran's International Airport. Aviation records show the plane is registered to the Bank of Utah through an arrangement in which the bank serves as a trustee for aircraft owners. The bank also confirmed Tuesday that the company, Engineers and Planners, is using the plane. With some exceptions, federal regulations generally prohibit economic activity between the U.S. and Iran. Engineers and Planners says the trip did not violate any international aviation laws. And that does it for today's local headlines. You're listening to The Rundown here on KCPW. Stay with us. A report released this month by the Sierra Club highlights parts of the state of Utah for having enormous untapped fossil fuel reserves, which, if extracted and burned, would greatly exacerbate climate change. Today, we're joined in studio by the Sierra Club's Tim Wagner to learn more. Tim, thanks very much for coming in today.
You bet. Happy to be here.
There are some specific regions of our state that appear in this report that was released earlier this month by the Sierra Club. Where are these regions, and what is it that the report is actually highlighting?
The report looks at 4 major areas in the country, or I guess what I want to call fossil fuel deposits. And then we do a calculation on the amount of carbon that is currently in the ground that will yet be emitted if all these resources are mined and combusted and so forth. And we use calculations based on information put out by the General Accounting Office, also the Energy Information Administration by the federal government. And so we just put a number on the amount of carbon emissions that would come from these regions. So the four regions we looked at, of course, drilling in the Arctic, which is obviously highly controversial. We also looked at the Powder River Basin, major coal deposit in Montana and Wyoming,
right,
which supplies about 42% of the coal in the U.S. They also looked at various deposits of oil and gas all over the country, including the very controversial Marcellus Shale in the northeastern part of the country, the San Juan Basin in northwestern New Mexico, and then other areas like in California. And then we also took a major look at the Green River Formation, which is this area that encompasses a good portion of Utah, Wyoming, and Colorado.
Right.
And it's a specific geological formation that contains massive amounts of not only oil and gas reserves, but also oil, shale, and tar sands.
And does that encompass the Uinta Basin here in Utah, that
yes,
formation?
Okay. Absolutely it does.
Okay. A lot of what we're talking about here is natural gas extraction, right?
A lot of it is, yes, yes.
And it seems, I mean, this is me kind of editorializing a little bit, but it seems like in the not-too-distant past, natural gas was seen as a quote-unquote green alternative to oil and gasoline. That doesn't seem to be the case any longer because of what we've learned.
That's very true. I mean, there's no doubt that the actual carbon or CO2 emissions from burning natural gas is about 50% on the average from what coal is. But when you look at the entire carbon spectrum of extracting the natural gas and getting it out of the ground and transporting it to the market, the carbon footprint of that particular resource goes up dramatically. You look at the leakage that's coming from the various infrastructure across the country with methane leakage, if it's going in. Methane, we know, has an intensity in terms of influencing climate change, which is about 100 times greater than CO2. And so that's a very dangerous component. So it makes the actual climate disrupting footprint of natural gas go up dramatically.
So you've highlighted these specific regions, including the Green River Formation here in Utah. What is it that you guys are trying to get across? I mean, you say that if we were to tap these resources, we would be undoing some policy gains made in recent years. Is that right?
That's exactly right. The intent of the report is to, one, first and foremost, inform. And then when people are informed, they can make a much better choice in terms of how they select candidates and vote and so forth, and what kind of policies they want to support. But the purpose of the report is to really highlight the amount of threat that's coming at us from all this dirty energy development, and particularly when we talk about the Green River Formation. And an icon of what the report really represents, for example, is where we looked at the amount of carbon emissions that are saved from new CAFE standards. That would be the new mileage standards for vehicles that were implemented by the Obama administration.
Right.
And we can clearly show that by the government's own estimates, the amount of carbon emissions that would be saved by implementing those measures in mileage standards would result in about 6 billion metric tons, 6 billion with a B, metric tons of CO2 into the atmosphere. Substantial. That's one of the biggest gains we've seen yet it's clearly the biggest gain we've seen from any policy so far implemented by the federal government.
These fuel standards.
These fuel standards, okay, in terms of addressing climate change. That would be totally offset by just 10%. If we just, for example, just drilled and processed 10% of the amount of oil shale, the oil shale being a rock in the Green River Formation in the tri-state area, and burnt that for energy use, that would result in 48 billion metric tons of CO2. In other words, 8 times the amount of savings we would gain from these CAFE standards. Just so you put that in perspective, you start looking at all these other resources I mentioned in these other areas, and you start to understand the magnitude of the problem.
For just this one location. I got to ask, though, I mean, this is, in some ways, this is the paradigm we operate under right now in terms of how we go about getting our energy, not so much oil shale, but although that is becoming an increasing source, but natural gas, oil and gas. What, you know, are we pursuing strongly enough alternative energy sources?
That's a broad question, but the blanket answer is no, we are not. I mean, quite clearly, we are not. We are actually pursuing dirty energy at a much faster rate than we ever have before in the history of this country. And I often tell people that every dollar that we invest whether it's publicly or privately, in fossil fuel development is a dollar that doesn't get invested in clean energy and our future. And so, you know, while we are trying to make a transition, and we're certainly seeing tremendous gains across the country in solar and wind applications, for example, I mean, the wind energy is certainly the fastest growing energy sector in the country right now. Yep. And it has been that way for several years and will continue to be that way. It's not growing at the rate that we need to see it grow.
So let's talk about what's happening here in Utah specifically in terms of the continued pursuit of the extraction economy. We talked about the Green River Formation, Uinta Basin. There is this Estonian company with big plans in the Uinta Basin that is mentioned in the report. Tell us, if you can, about Enefit and what their plans are.
Enefit currently, they're an Estonian company, and they've been using oil shale for many, many years, basically crushing it and burning it like coal. That's what they've been doing for a long, long time. So when you hear Congress people like Rob Bishop talk about, well, Estonia has been successfully using oil shale, that's true, but they burn it like coal. They've only within the last 5 to 10 years begun to develop processes where they can actually extract the kerogen, which is not an oil, but it's actually a derivative of, a much younger derivative of fossil fuels. And the kerogen has to be then processed through many, many ways in terms of get it into finally a fuel that you can use. It isn't like sticking a straw in the ground and bringing oil out of the ground. Completely different.
You have to process it a lot to make it essentially a liquid that can be then put into whatever.
Exactly, exactly. And what Estonia is doing is they currently have about 30,000 acres of state lands in northeastern Utah under lease, with approximately about the same number of acreages on private lands under lease as well. And they also have plans to acquire leases on federal BLM lands in the same region. And they have estimated just in what they have for lease holdings, they could see a harvest of about 2.6 billion barrels of crude oil, a tremendous amount of oil. But this stuff is not easy. Basically, it's like trying to get oil out of a rock, which is what oil shale really is. It isn't an oil. It's a rock. And they have to go through this retort process where they have to heat the rocks to tremendous temperatures and hold it there for periods of time to allow the kerogen to seep out. And then the kerogen has to be collected in some form or another and then shipped to another processing facility where then it's then refined and refined and refined into something that's actually a usable fuel. Takes a tremendous amount of energy and a tremendous amount of water. Estimates are anywhere from 2 to 5 barrels of water per barrel of oil. So if a barrel of oil is roughly 42 gallons, start to do the math. So if we're talking about 2.6 billion barrels of crude, take that times 42, and then you start to understand the amount of water in an already starved watershed in an arid region already that is, you know, in a watershed where we supply the water to 35 million people downstream on the Colorado River. This is all in the watershed, by the way.
The dichotomy that you run up against is, look, this is the economy that we live in. These are jobs that are being created. This is capital that's being moved. And so whatever process leads to greater jobs and greater development in this area is beneficial to the state. That is kind of the argument of state lawmakers. They want to see oil shale and tar sands tapped here in Utah. And to pursue that industry, they're pretty fervently pushing for it. You mentioned Rob Bishop. How do you combat those pushes? What is your sort of alternative when it comes to especially the economic argument?
Well, first of all, I would say I understand the need for jobs and the need for revenue. And I certainly understand some of the county commissioners and rural parts of the state that would like to see those resources develop because it does equate into revenues for their local governments and so forth and so on. But the counter argument in a nutshell, it's a boom and bust. It will go boom and bust, just like oil, just like coal, just like natural gas. It's a finite resource. When it's gone, it's gone. You have nothing left. And in a state like Utah, where we are blessed with not only an abundance of renewable energy potential, such as solar and wind and geothermal, but also a tremendous outdoor recreation and tourism economy that is just exploding in this state and will continue to grow if we protect that goose. Those are long-term sustainable economies that will be here for generations and generations to come. And I cite an example like, you know, Vernal, for example, which is in the heart of the oil patch, so to speak.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a lot going on out there right now. You can't drive up and down Main Street without being just totally flooded with exhaust from trucks going back and forth, and it's not a pleasant environment, but it's a lot of money rolling into the economy. But that's not going to last. It's not going to last. And, you know, give them 5 years, give them 10 years, what are they going to have? They're putting literally all their eggs into one basket. And that's unfortunate. That's going to leave somebody on the short end of the stick. In fact, a lot of people.
So you're talking about taking a generational view of things, both from not just the global level, but also from the local economic, the local economy's perspective as well, investing in things that are going to be there and not go bust.
Completely. Absolutely. You can. Are you going to have, you know, $30 an hour jobs, like what you have in the oil patch now? No, but you will have jobs and you will have an economy that will be there a generation or two generations or three generations from now. It'll grow.
So, okay, we're talking a little bit about what's happening there in the Green River Formation. There's a number of projects that are highlighted here in Utah, one of which is U.S. Oil Sands Tar Sands Project on the Tavaputs Plateau. What's going on there?
There again, at U.S. Oil Sands, which is not a U.S. company, they're a Canadian-based company, but they conveniently named themselves U.S. Oil Sands. It's in the PR Springs area, which is kind of in the southern reaches of the Tavaputs, about 60 miles north of the Moab. And it's a project permitted on about 32,000 acres of state land. They have their permits in place. They don't really have an operation in place yet. They have some infrastructure out there. I think the only hold up that they currently have is maybe some investment that they need to really get the thing launched. They have estimated about 1.2 billion barrels of crude oil that could come out of their lease holdings.
And this is crude oil from tar sands, which is different than your common oil well. Maybe you could describe that. Really.
Absolutely. Tar sands is basically just kind of the way it sounds. It's basically a bitumen, which is a black fossil fuel derivative or, you know, a component kind of like coal. But it's a little more gooey than that in most places. And the bitumen or the hydrocarbon is attached to a substrate. And in this case, locally, it's sand. Mm-hmm. Versus like the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, which is, you know, partially tied to the Keystone XL pipeline controversy.
Right.
Up there, it's more of a soil composite as the backbone of the tar sands.
Kind of a misnomer for tar
yeah,
sands up there.
Yeah. But here it's more because we have much sandier soils in Utah than they do in the Alberta region. So there's a lot more sand. And there's some places you can wander along the creek beds and places, cliff sides in the Tavaputs, in other places in the state where you can actually see this stuff just laying there. And when it's been exposed, it becomes hard and brittle like tar does. But in order for it to be processed and used in a way that we would like to be used, it has to be separated from that substrate, i.e. the sands. And the only way we can do that here in Utah is through some type of a chemical process that would extract the bitumen from the sand. Up in Alberta, they use hot water because it's a more soluble substrate.
Right.
And where here, it requires some type of a chemical to release it from the substrate.
The chemical stays behind, though, and you get the liquid product.
Exactly. And I want to be very clear with this point. U.S. Oil Sands will say that they have developed a process that they use this, what they call a citrus-based chemical that releases the hydrocarbons from the substrate. And they say because it's citrus-based, you know, basically based from orange peels, that it's not harmful to the environment. The problem with that argument is it's completely false because it isn't the citrus so much as it creates the environmental hazard. It's release of the hydrocarbons. No matter how you release the hydrocarbons, once they become soluble and mobile within the environment, that's when the threat starts to become real. That's when things start to move and they can contaminate water sources and air and so forth and so on and pollute the environment.
That the hydrocarbons themselves are the toxin.
And all the chemicals that come with them.
You know, I'm just looking at our time here. Tim, I'm going to try and move us along a little bit. I wanted to turn to coal burning and coal-fired power plants. Isn't that where the majority of our electricity comes from here in the United States?
It is, but it's dropping. It's dropping dramatically. Up until about 8-9 years ago, roughly 52% of our electricity came from burning coal. That's now down around 40% or less. And it's largely being displaced by mostly natural gas and some renewable energy. As we have become more what I call energy aware in this country and also more climate aware, people are wanting cleaner sources. and also the fact that the EPA and the regulatory agencies are stepping up in terms of trying to, you know, control carbon and pollution emissions from burning coal because it's one of the dirtiest forms of energy there is. And so as a result, the market is starting to drive coal use downward. And so that has resulted in new natural gas being utilized. You know, up until about 10 years ago, there were roughly 150 to 200 new coal plants being proposed across the country. Most of those got stopped. Very few of those got built because of just this energy awareness and utilities looking at the extreme cost of building new coal plants versus natural gas.
Right, the changing revenue projections and yep. what was more economically feasible.
Right.
For a while, though, there's this concept that was being promoted by the coal industry, clean coal. What is clean coal?
Clean coal, in a nutshell, was basically a label that was established to this technology called Integrated Gasification Combined Cycle, or IGCC, which was a process where you burn the coal, and before you release the CO2, which happens when you burn coal, you capture that CO2 and bury it underground. That technology is not proven to pan out. Economically, it just hasn't really panned out. It's a misnomer. It really hasn't come through to what people were saying it would, how it would come out.
Okay. So, I mean, the intent, though, would have been to pump the CO2 emissions underground, deep enough underground that you would hope that they would stay there.
Right.
Finally, it's Earth Day, and so I thought I'd ask you a question about the direction that we're headed. 6 years ago at the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference, world leaders set a goal of allowing no more than a 2 degrees Celsius rise in global temperatures. Now scientists say that if we continue to burn at the levels that we're burning at today, we'll reach that threshold in about 15 years. But globally, we're expected to see a net increase in emissions as opposed to burning at the current level or even decreasing, which is obviously an ideal from the perspective of climate change. And then we have China's increasing industrialization being a big part of that. I'm just wondering, are you optimistic that we can tackle this problem?
I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm probably not as optimistic as I was 10 years ago in this problem because we've lost a lot of time, valuable time in terms of addressing the problem. But I also understand when you look at the amount of renewable energy, for example, that's being generated in this country, wind energy, for example, I mean, somewhere around the range of 15,000 megawatts of wind gets generated and brought online every year. You know, I mean, it's growing rapidly. And the solar is now, we're seeing tremendous increases in solar. I'm cautiously optimistic that in the next 10 years, we're going to see dramatic cutbacks in the amount of CO2 emissions. We're seeing a huge influx in electric cars where we'd never even thought possible even 5 years ago. It's becoming the mainstay. People are buying electric cars all over the place. I think the market's going to continue to improve. These things are going to become much more economically viable and reachable for all consumers. And I think in the next 10 years, you're going to see a dramatic drop in CO2 emissions. Is it going to be enough? I don't know. I have my doubts. I really do. Mm. We move slowly. We do in this country. We move slowly. And public opinion just doesn't turn around on a dime, that's for sure. But we tend to learn when my neighbor does this and I see, oh, that maybe that works for me, I'll do the same thing. It's kind of a slow transition, and I think we're getting there, but not as quickly as we would like it to be.
Yeah, okay, so you're talking about the national position here, but how about from the global perspective, and we do look at these emerging economies, you know, around the world, China's a big one, but then, you know, you can look at Africa and Latin America and projected development in those areas. I mean, it doesn't mean that we should stop doing what we're doing here, I guess. Right?
No, but I think we clearly have the opportunity to set the example for the world. We have done that so many ways over the years, you know, in the history of the U.S. as being a leader in many, many ways. And we can continue to do the same thing. We need the political will to do it. It's not that the opportunities aren't there. They're out there now. But we just need the political will to do it. And I think it always comes back down to how you vote. You know, there's an old saying in this world that I work in, think globally, act locally. And I think that's what people need to really do. Look at who you're voting for when you go to the booth. Get engaged and be involved and know what's going on. Things do move, but it just takes slower than we would like.
And again, that was Tim Wagner, national staff with the Sierra Club's Our Wild America campaign in Utah. You can find the interview and all of our past conversations at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. Thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be speaking with Dr. J. Craig Venter, known for his work on the sequencing of the human genome. Among other things, we'll talk about the science of synthetic genomics and the concept of designing new species in advance of his Natural History Museum of Utah lecture on Thursday. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.